Well, let's turn to Genesis chapter 11. We're going to start with the last few verses and then go on into chapter 12. So let's turn to Genesis chapter 11. And we'll start with verse 26, with a man named Terah, or Terah in Hebrew. Genesis 11:26. When Terah had lived 70 years, he begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the chronicles of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, as it's pronounced in Hebrew, and Haran. And Haran begot Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of Terah, his father, in his native land, in Ur Kasdim. And Abram and Nahor took themselves wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took his son Abram and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of Abram, his son. And they departed with them from Ur Kasdim to go to the land of Canaan. They arrived at Haran, and they settled there. Now the person Haran, which is spelled most English versions H-A-R-A-N, and the town Haran, H-A-R-A-N, are not the same word in Hebrew. One is spelled with a chet, the other is spelled with a hey. Haran is the man. Haran is the city. So don't try to look for spiritual connections there too much, because they're not the same word, though they may look the same in our English translations. Let's continue. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Adonai said to Abram, go for yourself from your land, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. So Abram went as Adonai had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and Lot his brother's son, and all their wealth that they had amassed, and the souls they made in Haran. And they left to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed into the land as far as the site of Shechem, until the plain of Moreh. The Canaanite was in the land. Adonai appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there to Adonai, who appeared to him. From there he relocated to the mountain east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And he built there an altar to Adonai and invoked Adonai by name. Then Abram journeyed on, journeying steadily toward the south. And that's as far as we'll go this evening. For 11 chapters of Genesis, almost a fourth of the book, we've seen the creation of the heavens and the earth. We've seen the people multiply. We've seen Adam and Eve sin. We've seen the temptation by Satan in the garden. We've seen the world flooded and everyone wiped out except for Noah and his family on the ark, the Teva. And then we see all these people multiply again. And then there's the Tower of Babel that Nimrod builds, this man who defied God to his face. And God scatters the people, confuses their languages, they go all over the world. And then everything focuses down to this man Terah, his three sons, and the one son, Abram, who goes on alone, leaves his family, and goes on into Canaan. And now the Bible really begins. Because everything up to this point has been simply setting the stage. Everything to this point has been introduction. Everything's been a preface to Abraham, this one man. Now, that sounds kind of odd to us, because this is about the time we start getting bored because we think, oh, the creation is so fascinating, and science and evolution, ice ages and dinosaurs and arcs, and everything's so, wow, look at that. And then we get to this man, Abram. And it's like, okay, this is where it kind of starts to slow down and drag. And you know, that's exactly the opposite way you should look at it. I was thinking recently about the video we saw during the prayer service. I think it was Our God's an Awesome God. Was that the name of it? And the man was showing the size of the earth, and then the size of the other planets, and the size of the sun, and then the size of another star, and then the Canis Majoris, with this huge star that makes our sun look about the size of a grain of sand. And I mean, it's awesome. It's just like mind-blowing. You can't even begin to comprehend these sizes. We're all sitting around watching this with our jaws dropped, like, wow, I feel so tiny and so small. And when you watch something like that, you think, well, there have to be, in all the millions of galaxies, billions of galaxies, and all the billions of stars in each of these billions of galaxies, and the billions of planets, there have to be other life forms, other maybe intelligent creatures, and we can't be the only ones. And we start to think that we're just kind of this little blip in this huge universe. And in one way, we are. But now try to use your imagination and look at the creation from the side of the spiritual realm instead of the physical. And this is hard to do. This is really hard to do because we're so attuned to the physical. Sizes, measuring sizes of things and measuring time and measuring all these things. But when it gets to the spiritual, we kind of scratch our heads because we don't comprehend the spiritual very well. It's because it's not physical. But from the spiritual realm, size means nothing. Nothing. In the spiritual realm, big and little are equally as impressive or not. Size means zero. Nothing. Zilch. Zada. Now I'm sure that in the spiritual realm, the angels are impressed by the very fact that God created a physical realm. And the complexity with which He made it, the artistry, the beauty with which He made it. But size doesn't mean squat. Because a spiritual being can just instantly appear, disappear, go here, go there, just at the speed of thought. And these creatures are unaffected by vacuums or heat or cold. They just, it means nothing to them. They're spiritual. So the question arises, what does mean something in the spiritual realm? In the spiritual realm, what is considered big? What is considered massive? What is considered grand? And I'll tell you what it is. The story. The story, truth. The story of grace. The story of self-sacrifice. Love. These qualities that we talk about and put in poems and songs as nice things, but you know, it's like, but I really need money and I need a job and I'd like to be healthier and I'd like to live longer. I want a bigger house. Love and all those other things are fine. But in the spiritual realm, these are the things that make the angels drop their jaws and think, wow. See, there don't need to be any other intelligent creatures on other planets. I don't believe there are. I believe this is it. And we may seem so tiny, and small and insignificant in the size universe, but you see the story that's happening here is absolutely enormous. It is so grand it makes the big dog star look like a pea. Okay? The story of Yeshua, of the Word of God, God's very communications, God's essence becoming flesh and dwelling among us, humbling Himself to be a creature made out of dust. And then humbling Himself further to die on a cross out of pure, unadulterated love. And He lavishes His grace on it. That story in the spiritual realm is a supernova. You see? And the story of a man who simply hears a word from God to leave your family, leave your land, leave everything is familiar, and go to a land I'll show you. And by that simple act of faith, He does it. That's massive in the spiritual realm. Huge. That's universe altering. Can you begin to grasp what I'm trying to say? You may seem so small, and you may think, well, the little mitzvot I do, the little good deeds I do, the little widow's mites I contribute to this world are nothing. But our Creator promises that those works are not forgotten, and what is done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. He's going to take little in this world and make it big in the next. And He's going to take big in this world and make it insignificant in the next. Being President of the United States, I mean, that's top dog in this world. And knowing the next world, it means nothing. A custodian, a pipe fitter, an electrician, a janitor, the mechanic may get immense glory in the world to come because of their selfless spirit, their Messiah-like love and giving. And that's what's going to be proclaimed. Look at this world. Yeah, but I'm the president. Go away. Look at this. You see what I'm saying? So don't ever take things physically and say that's small, therefore it's insignificant, that's big, that's important. The spiritual realm is the other way around. You know, when Yeshua was with his disciples at the temple, and they're watching people drop money and the offerings, they had these big trumpet-shaped receptacles. They had different ones at the temple, so you could give to different projects. And these people are taking their bags of gold, these rich people, and they're, shaking them and dropping it. Boom! I imagine it made a big sound when it went down this metal trumpet-shaped thing into the box down the bottom. And then along comes the widow. He puts in the two smallest coins, little widow's mites, just about so big, size of your little fingernail. She drops them in. Nobody notices. And Yeshua doesn't say that what she did is really important to me. He didn't say, even though it's all she had, I mean, it really means a lot, and I really appreciate what she did. Get what he says. He says, she gave more. Now, that doesn't make good physical math. Physical realm, that makes no sense. She didn't give more. Two mites, bag of gold, there's no comparison. But Yeshua saw things with the eyes of the Spirit. And spiritually, she gave more, way more than all the rest put together. How can that be? Well, I wish somehow, and someday we will, I believe this with all my heart, someday we'll see what the gold accomplished from the rich men. But I want to see what those two mites accomplished somehow. How somehow those were used to touch a life, to change a life that maybe changed a world. I don't know how it happened, but she gave more. Messiah was not exaggerating. He was speaking the unadulterated truth, pure truth. She gave more. You understand? So we come to this one individual, to Abram. And now the story becomes colossal. Creation of the world, that's nice. But this world passes away, right? But what Abraham did, what God used Abraham to do, what God demonstrates to Abraham, the grace and the faith that Abraham demonstrates, this doesn't pass away. This is permanent. This is forever. And it's massive. And it's huge. And we are even grafted into Abraham. We're grafted into the work he did. So don't judge by the physical. Don't judge by the physical. If God can cover the whole creation of the world and the population of the world, from the destruction of the world, the repopulation of the world, the confusion of the languages, covers all that in 11 chapters. But then here he gives, I think, about 14 chapters to one man. You tell me which is more important to God. You see? And not only that, but Abraham is mentioned over and over and over again all throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, all throughout the New Testament. He's always looked at as the example of faith, of salvation by grace through faith. It's a huge story. This is the Canis Majoris. This is the big dog star in the Bible, next to Yeshua, of course. Yeshua is don't get any bigger than that. He is the light of the world. So, but I want you to grasp what I'm saying here. It's very important for you to appreciate what's happening here. Okay. Well, let's look at something here that doesn't make sense physically. If you do the math, you see here that Terah was 70 years old when he had Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And then you see that Abram was 75 when he went to Canaan. Then how old was Terah when Abram went to Canaan? 70 plus 75 is 145 years old, right? But then we have a problem. Because it tells us that Terah lived until he was 205. The last verse of chapter 11, the days of Terah were 205 years. And Terah died in Haran. Now let's review this. Terah is 70 years old when Abram and his brothers are born. Okay? Abram's 75 and he goes to Canaan. That would make Terah 145 years old, right? When Abram goes to Canaan. Terah dies at the age of 205. So Abram would have left his father Terah 60 years before his father died. You're probably thinking, well, Grant, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is this. Over in Acts chapter 7, verse 4, Stephen, the first Messianic martyr, is giving his testimony. He's reviewing the history of his people. And he says very specifically that after Abraham's father died, he went to Canaan. I have no answer for that, but I just thought I'd share that with you. You know, I think what it is, though, is one thing is I think God has led it saying, you can do the math. It doesn't add up. We're talking about spirituality here. We're talking about holy ground. And you're going to have to take a certain part of your intellect, and you're just going to have to leave that unsatisfied, because this is spiritual food. It feeds something different. On the other hand, there are some sources Stephen might have had available to him that we don't have. It could be Abram was not the firstborn, even though he's listed first. He might have been the youngest. Wouldn't that kind of be poetic? Because this is always the youngest that God seems to use. Always uses the youngest son. David, the youngest, uses Isaac, who's younger than Ishmael. He uses Jacob, who's younger than Esau. He uses Joseph, who's younger than his other brothers, except for Benjamin. You know, it seems like God has this way of kind of turning things upside down or right side up, who knows which. So it could be Abram was the youngest. So when Terah was 70, he begot one of the sons, then later one of the sons, and then eventually, by the time he was 130, then he begat Abram. So there are different ways to work it out. But it's kind of interesting that the counts don't quite jive. It's almost as if God's given us a heads up. Pay attention here, because I'm going to shake your world a little bit. Well, let's go to chapter 12. It's suggested by a lot of the histories that Haran was actually the town where Terah was originally from. That Terah had been born and raised in Haran and then gone to Ur of Chasdim, and then later when Abram was spoken to by God, he shares with his father, so the whole family goes back to Haran, but that's as far as the family goes. Abram continues on his way. And then God said to Abram, chapter 12, verse 1, Lech Lecha. These are very important words. By the way, let me show this to you. This kind of goes back, almost forgot about this overhead. This whole thing about the world being created to set the stage for Abraham, I'm going to back up to this for a second. Here's Genesis 2:4. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, and the day that Adonai Elohim made the earth and the heavens. Now, the underlying words, when they were created, it's only one word in Hebrew. And there it is. That is how it appears in the Torah scroll. Behibaram. And you notice the second letter, the hay, is real small and up in the air. That's the way it is in our Torah scroll here at Beth Tikkun. That's the way it is in every Torah scroll in the world. And if it's not, then that Torah scroll is not valid. It has to have the small hay lifted up. And so the rabbis teach that whenever a letter is written extra small or extra large, and there's no rule for this, but just tradition that certain letters are written small in certain words, sometimes a certain letter in a certain word is written large, that there's something God wants to teach. He's like saying, look at this, let me catch your attention, look more deeply into this word, because there's a lesson there. And so they come up with a couple things. They say, one of them might be, is this. You see, the word bara, he created, barashit, bara, Elohim, at the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Baram can be created them, and with the bait, it can mean, with the letter he, he created them. He is just, okay, it's just breath, like the letter H. So it's saying that with his breath, he created the whole heavens and the earth. They say that's one possibility. But they say there's another possibility, which is just as valid. Because if you rearrange the six letters, they spell for Abraham. If you rearrange those letters, it can just as easily say, there's Abraham's name, Avraham. And the bait in front is one. By the way, I have to make a correction from last week. I used the term inseparable pronoun last week. And I knew when I said that, something didn't seem right, but I was, you know, you can't jump off a speeding car. And I just kept on going. And about 2 in the morning, I'm still sitting on my desk, Saturday night, late, 2 in the morning. I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden it's like, it's an inseparable preposition, you dummy. It's an inseparable, it wasn't an inseparable pronoun. It's a bit of heresy, I'd like you to correct. It's an inseparable preposition. And also, my Hebrew students, I'm going to let you know you've all been docked a letter grade for not correcting that last week. So, but this is an inseparable preposition. You put a bait on the front of the word, it means in or with or for. So it can read this way. And when a Hebrew scholar reads Genesis, he sees all three of these when he reads this verse. But this is the way I want us to look at it just for tonight. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created for Abraham. And the day that Adonai Elohim made the earth and the heavens. Another unique thing about this verse is the very first verse in the Bible where God's four-letter name, Yud He Vav He, we say Adonai, which means Lord, but in the Hebrew it's Yud He Vav He, his four-letter holy name. It's the first place it appears in the Bible. So it's like God is revealing himself, but he's hinting at Abraham. Later, Abraham comes on the scene, and he begins to get a hint about Adonai. Then finally, Adonai speaks to him. And then when he goes to Canaan, God reveals himself to him. And you'll also notice in this verse, these are generations of the heavens and the earth. But what does it say at the end? When he made the earth and the heavens, they're reversed. If there's a reversal there, God's saying, this is a menorah, put it together. And so this is what it comes out like. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created for Abraham and the day that Yud He Vav He Elohim made the earth and the heavens. That arrow should be going up instead of down. See the pictures being painted by this verse? Heavens and earth are just bookends. Just the stage props, the two curtains that are pulled back, so we can display the great story of one man and his creator, his Lord. Everything else is stage dressing. Everything else is props. Temporary. But the story is permanent. I want you to think about something for a moment. A Shakespeare play. Shakespeare plays have been read and studied by high school students as literature teachers have inflicted them upon their students for centuries. And it's just something we do. 400 years, people have been studying Shakespeare plays. I don't know we have any of the props or we're using any of the original Shakespeare plays. The props are temporary. Whatever props Shakespeare and his actors used to put on the plays, we don't have those anymore. They're gone. But the play itself endures. The words and the story endures. That's the same thing here. This heaven and earth was created, and it says it's going to be just all folded up, rolled up like a scroll, melted away by an intense heat. We don't need the props anymore. But the story endures. You follow what I'm saying? Let's put the importance where the importance belongs. Okay. Genesis 12:1. Now Adonai said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." That word go only has to be two letters in Hebrew, bo. In fact, in Exodus, there is a whole Torah portion called bo. It's where God's telling Moses, go to Pharaoh. But that's not the word used here. Two words are used here. Lech lecha. In fact, this Torah portion, if you're using a Hebrew Bible, this Torah portion is the beginning of lech lecha. And this is what those two words look like. They're identical. Lamed kaf. Lamed kaf. The word lech comes from the word halak. Halak means to walk. That's where we get the word halakha. You know, the rabbis are always talking about halakha, how to walk out the commandments. In some way, say, you walk them out this way. And others, no, you do that commandment this way. So they're always arguing about halakha, how to walk out the commandments. This is a shortened version, just lech. It's a command form. Lech. But we pronounce this lecha. So we can translate this a couple ways. You, yeah, you, go. Lech, lech. Okay? That's one way to go at it. But lecha, the second word, can also mean, there's one of those inseparable prepositions, remember? Lamed means to or toward. Go for your own sake. Ha on the end means you. Baruch atah, v'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha. Okay? Your God, you shall love the Lord your God. Go for yourself. Go for your sake. Most translations say, get yourself, okay? Get yourself gone, kind of, so to speak. But there's another way this can be translated. And again, when a Hebrew scholar reads these words, all of these are going through their mind when they read lech lecha. It means, go to yourself. You know, last week we talked about Nimrod. And what did the people say in Nimrod's day? Let's rise up and let's make bricks. Now when Exodus opens, there's another tyrant charge in Egypt, and he's making the Israelis make bricks against their will. They'd have taskmasters and whips and chains and had to make the people make bricks. They didn't want to make bricks. It was imposed upon them. It was an exterior slavery. It was not a mental slavery. They didn't want to make bricks. They had to make bricks. But under Nimrod, the people wanted to make bricks. They had an internal slavery. We talked last week about how it was this groupthink sort of thing. They all thought as one. And they were all just in adoration of this tyrant, Nimrod. Let's make bricks. Let's build a tower. Let's make a city. And it was out of this that God calls Abram. Out of this kind of setting. It was generations later, but this was the kind of setting. And God calls an individual. And he says, lech lecha, go for your own sake. Go toward yourself. Go for yourself. From your land, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land I will show you. These are the first words we have recorded that God spoke to Abram. Now, with this in mind, we have to remember that in the New Testament scriptures, in Romans and in Galatians, it tells us very specifically that if we halak, if we walk in faith, we are children of Abraham. He is our forefather. Which means every one of us must obey God's first command to us, Lech Lecha. Break out of the pack. Think for yourself. Now, one of the things that's such a blessing at Beth Tikkun is none of you were just born into Beth Tikkun. You all had to Lech Lecha to get here. I don't know if the next generation that grows up and replaces us here will have that same spirit. Because they didn't choose this place. Their parents chose it, and they were born here. And when they hear God's call, Lech Lecha, what will that mean to them? I don't know. I don't know what the next step is, the next step of faith God will call them to. But I know one thing. If they just try to inherit your faith and just try to live your faith and let your faith be sufficient for them, they're going to wind up legalistic, they're going to wind up discontent, and they're going to wind up spiritually duds. You cannot inherit your father's faith. You must claim it as your own, and now it's yours. But each of us must obey the command, Lech Lecha. But see, we like comfort. There's something about us that's got that Nimrod mindset. We like sameness. We find security and no change. Don't change anything. All right? And boy, I tell you what, when God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, He shook their fear of change out of them. He shook it out of them. And He had to build a tabernacle, not a temple. Because every morning they got up, probably the first thing they look, is the cloud still over the tabernacle or has it gone up? If it's gone up, we've got to pull up stakes and go. Can you imagine? I've sometimes have had this little story run through my mind. Maybe make a good children's book. But hopefully it's going to make a good sermon now. Maybe a children's book later. But picture you're one of the Jews who've come out of Egypt, all right? You cross the Red Sea, you've come to Sinai, you received the Torah, the tabernacle's been built, and you've been traveling through the wilderness. And then the cloud stops, they put up the tabernacle, everybody puts their tents up, cook dinner, go to bed. They get up in the morning, cloud's still there. So they go up, they get their manna for the day, boil some, fry some, eat some, whatever, just whatever, visit, yak with the friends, go to bed. Get up the next morning, cloud's still there. Next morning, cloud's still there. Next morning, the next week, the next month. Let's say the next 2 or 3 years, the cloud still stays right there over the tabernacle. And by then, some of these people thought, you know, this cloud's never moving. They start building houses. They start putting down foundations. They start building walls. They take the soil, make bricks. They put roofs. They put rooms. They put furniture in there. And they're getting all comfy. Then one day they get up, look over. Uh-oh. That cloud's moved. And now you got a real dilemma. Because you've become so invested in a temporary campsite that now it's become your security in your home. And now that God says, let's move. You got a choice. I can rest in security of this house I've invested in. Or I can find my security in my shepherd who's leading me to another field. We need to be very careful that we don't build temples. We just build tabernacles. Tabernacles, you pull up the stakes, you're ready to go. We need to be very careful we do that. We need to be very careful we do that with our theology. There are certain things in our theology that are we don't even argue about. They're true, we believe them, we accept them. We're going to be dogmatic about certain things. But you know, the things that the Bible's not emphatic about, we cannot afford to be emphatic about. And we need to be able to change our minds. We need to be able to leave our country, our family, and all that's familiar. I'm talking about spiritually speaking. And we need to decide, do I love God more, or do I love family tradition more? Because what does Yeshua say? Any man who loves father or mother, or brother, any relatives more than me, is not worthy of me. See, to follow God takes two things. Courage, joy. You lack one of those, you're not going to be a very good follower. Courage and joy. Courage and joy. And Abraham had these in spades. I tell you what, this man had courage and he had joy. Do you understand what I'm saying here? We need to be prepared to follow the Lord wherever He takes us. Not just physically. The physical part's the easy part. It's the mental and spiritual journey that every one of us has to travel and not get stuck. Not get stuck, but ready to move and follow Him. You understand? This adventure of the Holy Spirit leading us into all truth, that's the adventure of a lifetime. And it may take you other places geographically as well. But I promise you, it's not going to let you stay put mentally. It's not going to let you stay put theologically. God just simply does not allow that of His followers. If you follow Him, you must grow and follow Him every day in your mind and in your spirit. You understand? Be adventurous. Not heretics. Okay? Heretics are self-centered. But be one who's a faithful follower of Yeshua. Okay. There we go from this. All right, I want you to notice something else about this whole story. From Adam to Noah was 10 generations. Back in Genesis, I think it was chapter 5. I want to guess if it's chapter 5 is where it goes through those 10 generations from Adam to Noah. But you see, in chapter 11, it covers 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. Think about that. Every 10 generations, there's this massive change in the world. The world goes from being formless to void to being created, and here's Adam. And starts a whole new world, a new population. Populates this planet with people. But that all gets wiped out, and then God starts over with Noah. And now the world's populated with people again after 10 generations. And then God starts with a new man. A third start. You see, by the time they get to Noah, human race is filled with sexual sins, physical sins, immorality. By the time the world gets filled up from the 10 generations up to Abraham, now it's filled with spiritual sins, idolatry. And then God finds a man who's got the guts and the joy to follow Him. And He says, leave everything familiar, and I'll take you to a land. I'll show you. And he goes. That's the kind of faith that we must have in our God. Yes, Jim. Where the story is of Abraham. Yeah, there's all these things happening on the earth, but God zooms in on one individual. Yeah. Just a little side note. Adam starts with the letter Aleph. Noah starts with the letter Nun. Abraham starts with the letter Aleph. When you take those three letters, it spells out a word. It's a word we sing most weeks when we have a Torah service. When the Torah is being taken around and you touch the Torah. What's the song we sing? Ana Adonai. Hoshia na. Ana Adonai. Tzlicha na. What's Ana mean? We don't have an English word for it. But it means that from the very core of my being, God, I cry out to you, please help. That's what Ana means. Ana Adonai. Hoshia na, save now. And the generations, these 20 generations, finally culminated in this cry. And I think this is the cry that was in Abraham's heart. And when that cry is in your heart, then I think you're ready to follow Him. You're ready to follow Him. Because it's not religion anymore. It's life itself. It's not doctrine and theology anymore. It's the very essence of truth that you're dying to have. You're starving to have. So, Well, let's just ramp this up, a few details. Boy, all that for two words. Lech Lecha. Verse 2. And I will make of you a great nation. Last week we talked about how when God confused the languages at Babel, the world population broke up into 70 nations, right? And God says, but Abram, you're going to be 71. You're going to be 71. You're going to be the nation that I really invest my life and my truth in. And then he says, I will bless you and make your name great. If you go back to the story of the tower, what did the people do? They built the tower so they would stay one nation, one people, and they would make a name for themselves. But because Abram was willing to leave the pack, God says, I will make you a great nation and a blessing, and I will make a great name for you. I'm going to give you freely what all those people at the tower were trying to work so hard for. I'm going to give it to you. Not because you built a tower, because you built a life in my presence and obedience to my word. I will bless those who bless you. And him who curses you, I will curse. Now, there are two different words there used for curse. The way it reads in Hebrew is this. And him who kalahs you, I will aror. Now, what's the difference? The word kalah is a word for curse. It means to make light of, to reduce. Okay? When you hear people making light of the Jews, of the Jewish faith, of the Torah, of the nation of Israel, they're inviting a curse into their life from God. And that curse is called an aror. Now, aror is a little different from kalah. Kalah is external. It's outward. But aror is inward. Aror means to sap someone's strength and their vitality, to reduce their life level down. On the outside, they may look exactly the same, but inside, something's shriveling. And as people with their mouths speak not just curses, but just speak down on the Jewish people, speak down on the Jewish faith, upon the land of Israel, something inside them is just dying and dying and shriveling and weakening. That's what God says. He says, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. Bless themselves is the word vanivrachu. Vanivrachu. In the Talmud, there's a really interesting conversation. It's in Tractate Yavamot 63a. This is what it says. And further said Rabbi Eliezer, what is the meaning of the verse of Scripture? And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Said the Holy One, blessed be he, to Abraham, I have two good shoots to graft onto you, Ruth of Moab and Naomi of Ammon. You see what's being said here? Rabbi Eliezer, what he's doing, he's asking the question and answering it. He says, what does this mean? In you, Abraham, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. All the families of the earth shall be blessed. He says, this is what it means. God is saying, I've got two good shoots from a Gentile tree. Ruth, the Moabitess, and Naomi, the Ammonite. And I'm going to graft them in here. In other words, Rabbi Eliezer in the Talmud is saying, this is how the families of the earth are blessed, by being grafted into Abraham. That's it. That's how the families of the earth are blessed, by being grafted in. It's a powerful statement buried there. But I'm sure this was in Paul's mind, this concept was in Paul's mind, because Rabbi Eliezer lived long before Paul. I'm sure this was in his mind when he wrote Romans chapter 11 about the olive tree of Israel and the branch being broken off, and yet a wild branch, a wild olive tree, grafted in. Then he warns us as Gentiles, don't brag against the tree. Don't boast against it. Don't boast against the branches. And we're about to finish up. So Abram went as Adonai had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and Lot his brother's son and all their wealth that they had amassed and the souls they made in Haran. Abram had already been teaching. He had been making souls. And that's what it says in the Hebrew. Making souls. He'd been making converts already before he went to Canaan. Somehow he knew that God was God, that he was good, that he was only one. There were not many gods. Idolatry was awash. He knew there was this God. And his whole being cried out, Anah Adonai. I beg you, show yourself to me. There was something in Abraham. And the traditions, the legends about Abraham all support this. And he's making souls in Haran. He's already beginning to teach what little he knew had to be the truth about this wonderful God. And God speaks to him, Lech Lecha. But when he gets to Israel, when he gets to Canaan, it says God appears to him. And that's the final thing I want to share with you. When you start following God a little bit, God will start showing himself to you a lot. But there's no substitute for obedience. As we read from Perkei Avot this evening, not study, but doing, that's the thing. Of course, studying is very important. But being a hearer of the word, not a doer, makes you foolish. Being a hearer and a doer makes you blessed. And as James goes on, because then we experience the liberating Torah. Oh man, don't you want to be free? Abraham wanted that freedom to know who God is and to live in that God and to walk in Him. By George, he did. So he went to the north of Canaan, went down to Shechem, built his first altar there, went on further south to what they believe is Mount Moriah. It says he went to the mountain, which is there west, on the west, and Ai is on the east. They believe that is Mount Moriah, where later he would build an altar, chapter 22, where he would take his son Isaac, and then went on down into the south. It's almost like he's walking the country from the north to the south, saying, this is the land God's given me and to my children. So, we'll pick it up there next week. Are there any last minute questions or comments anyone has? Been so quiet. You all look sleepy. You've been eating too much matzah this week, haven't you? Okay. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Father, we do thank you so much for your word. What a blessing it is. And Father, I pray we would live as our father Abraham lived. We would walk in his faith. And Father, that you would be proud of us because we walk by faith and not just by sight, by what we see. So Lord, I pray that that voice, Anah Adonai, would cry from deep within our hearts. Because we're beseeching you, begging you to show us your ways, to make us the people you want us to be, to lead us the places you want us to go. First in our minds, our hearts, our spirits, and then anywhere in the world you'd have us to go. Lord, make us the kind of people who have the courage and the joy of Abraham, the courage and the joy of Yeshua. Lord, make us those kind of people, we pray, in Yeshua's name. Amen. Thank you.